This is Vatican Radio. In a change of scene from their usual gospel reflections, for this Sunday, Christmas, Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett bring us a glimpse of Christmas's past in London, from the eve of the outbreak of the First World War to the mid-1900s.
We open this Christmas interlude with an extract from Tennyson's In Memoriam, in which the sound of bells predominates, announcing the Christmas message of peace and goodwill.
The time draws near the birth of Christ. The moon is hid, the night is still. The Christmas bells from hill to hill answer each other in the mist. Four voices of four hamlets round, from far and near, on mead and moor, swell out and fail, as if a door were shut between me and the sound. Each voice four changes on the wind, that now dilate and now decrease. Peace and goodwill and peace and goodwill to all mankind.
Hearing the Christmas bells over half a century later, Robert Bridges was moved to write Noël, Christmas Eve, 1913.
A frosty Christmas Eve, when the stars were shining, fared I forth alone, where westward falls the hill, and from many a village in the watered valley, distant music reaching me, peals of bells a-ringing. The constellated sounds ran sprinkling on earth's floor, as the dark vault above with stars was spangled o'er. Then sped my thoughts to keep that first Christmas of all, when the shepherds, watching by their folds ere the dawn, heard music in the fields, and marvelling could not tell whether it were angels or the bright stars singing.
In his book, Before the Lamps Went Out, Geoffrey Marcus records the last year in England before the outbreak of the First World War. The opening suggests the tranquil atmosphere of that last Christmas of peace. Once again, bells are the protagonists, and ringing the changes is a serious business.
December 25th, 1913. 6 o'clock, of a sharp, frosty morning. One by one the bell ringers assembled at the old church under the South Downs, stamping and blowing on their numbed fingers. They stood in a circle with the ropes in their hands, intoning the ancient ritual words. Here goes one, and the joyful chimes rang out across the sleeping countryside. Some hours earlier, little groups of people might have been seen trudging across the darkened fields, a few miles off, on their way to midnight mass, for here and there throughout Sussex the old faith still survived. The manger in the little crib was empty, but presently the priest came in bearing the figure of the babe, which, as the people sang the opening carol, he laid gently in the hay.
Twelve months later, Europe was in the throes of what came to be known as the Great War. From its very outset, Pope Benedict XV, who had been elected on the 3rd of September, 1914, made strenuous and repeated diplomatic efforts to halt the conflict. His appeals were all ignored. Or were they? For on Christmas Day, 1914, something extraordinary happened. It's recounted in his memoirs by English Field Marshal Sir John French, commander of the British Expeditionary Force in France in 1914.
Although I've never heard it actually confirmed, I believe a suggestion was made by the Pope to all belligerent powers that armistice should be arranged for Christmas Day. It was further reported that the Central Powers had signified their assent, but that the Allied governments refused to entertain the proposal. The suggestion was certainly never referred either to Joffre or me. Whether this statement was true or not, it's certain that soon after daylight on Christmas morning, the Germans took a very bold initiative at several points along our front in trying to establish some form of fraternization. It began by individual unarmed men running from the German trenches across to ours, holding Christmas trees above their heads. These overtures were in some places favourably received, and fraternization of a limited kind took place during the day. It appeared that a little feasting went on, and junior officers, non-commissioned officers, and men on either side conversed together in no man's land. When this was reported to me, I issued immediate orders to prevent any recurrence of such conduct, and called the local commanders to strict account, which resulted in a good deal of trouble. I've since often thought deeply over the principle involved in the manifestation of such sentiments between hostile armies in the field. I'm not sure that had the question of the agreement upon an armistice for the day been submitted to me, I should have dissented from it.
Although it appeared in print the last Christmas of the war, Thomas Hardy's poem The Oxen is far removed from warlike themes. A fanciful tradition persisted among country people that on Christmas night farm animals knelt down in their stalls to worship the Christ child. The poet wistfully recalls the simple faith of past Christmases and expresses a wish.
Christmas Eve, and 12 of the clock. Now they are all on their knees, an elder said as we sat in a flock by the embers in hearthside ease. We pictured the meek, mild creatures, where they dwelt in their strawy pen, nor did it occur to one of us there to doubt they were kneeling then. So fair a fancy few would weave in these years. Yet I feel if someone said on Christmas Eve, "Come, see the oxen kneel in the lonely barton by yonder coombe our childhood used to know," I should go with him in the gloom, hoping it might be so.
A bachelor at Christmas time is usually to be found anywhere but at home. And theatre critic James Eggate, writing in the first half of the 20th century, was no exception. But living in London, as he did, his movements were regulated partly by atmospheric conditions. For London, as everyone knows, was frequently submerged in that combination of fog, smoke, and chemical fumes generally known as smog. As a student in the 50s, I remember many a pea souper, as we called them, when the buses simply stopped running. The climax came with the Great London Smog of December 1952, when more than 4,000 people died. This led to the passing of the Clean Air Act in 1956 and the setting up of smokeless zones. Today, pea soupers are a thing of the past. But let's go back now to the Christmas of 1937, when James Eggate wrote in his diary.
Christmas Day. This began by being brilliantly fine and sunny. At 11 o'clock, Lady Macbeth's blanket of the dark had nothing on the fog at Belsize Park, which by 11:30 rivaled the dunnest smoke of hell. It was so thick the taxis declined to leave their ranks. As everybody had gone on leave, I was marooned and should have starved had Fred not left a note saying I should find a cold turkey in the kitchen cupboard. In the evening the fog cleared and I was able to keep my engagement to dine at Monty's, which I've done every Christmas but one for 10 years.
2 years later, our diarist was not so lucky. On Christmas Eve, 1939, he noted simply dense fog. And on Christmas Day...
Christmas Day. Fog-bound, and unable to get to Monty's party. The second time I've defaulted in 10 years. Fortunately, Leo Pavier's marooned here with me, and has been for 2 days. He comes into the room saying, "There's a young woman at the telephone exchange who insists that it's 6:59 exactly." I tried to argue with her, but she wouldn't listen. I then found out that he'd rung Tim for the first time in his life, and didn't know she was mechanical.
The diary entry for the following day reads,
"Fog still bad in places, but manage to crawl to the Café Royal for dinner."
...1944, the last Christmas of the war. Fog is once more the protagonist, although it's not mentioned until the end. Eggett records that there are no newspapers, and that the Tube, the underground for non-Londoners, has declared a one-day strike. Buses have clearly been grounded. And an altruistic strain is suddenly awoken in our diarist, who blusters.
"I don't care what the quarrel is about or who's in the wrong. I only know that the Tube should have been kept running at any sacrifice, whether of money or face. I'm perfectly prepared to be miserable at all holiday seasons. What I'm angry about is that thousands of young men and women in the services should have their holiday ruined, and that the staff of the Café Royal should have to walk as many as 8 or 10 miles in the fog after their day's work."
No mention is made of it, but presumably our man, who was nothing if not a bon viveur, managed to crawl to the Café Royal for dinner. "The Café Royal," James Eggett once declared, "is my spiritual home. I sup there every night." But to do him justice, we should add that it was not merely good food which drew him to the celebrated restaurant, but also good conversation. In its heyday, the Café Royal had been the stamping ground of artists and writers, and frequented by wits such as Oscar Wilde and Max Beerbohm. But let's return to the essential Christmas spirit, and close with these thoughtful lines by John Meade Faulkner, written in 1911. Here now is Christmas Day, the family sitting.
"In the days of Caesar Augustus, there went forth this decree: Sequis rectus et justus liveth in Galilee. Let him go up to Jerusalem, and pay his scot to me. There are passed one after the other Christmases 53, since I sat here with my mother and heard the great decree, and how they went up to Jerusalem out of Galilee. They have passed one after the other. Father and mother died, brother and sister and brother, taken and sanctified. I am left alone in the sitting, with none to sit beside. On the fly leaves of these old prayer books the childish writings fade, which show that once they were their books in the days when prayer was made for other kings and princesses, William and Adelaide. The pillars are twisted with holly, and the font is wreathed with yew. Christ forgive me for folly, youth's lapses, not a few, for the hardness of my middle life, for age's fretful view. Cotton wool letters on scarlet, all the ancient lore, tell how the chieftain starlet to Bethlehem came to adore, to hail him king in the manger, wonderful counselor. The bells ring out in the steeple, the gladness of erstwhile, and the children of other people are walking up the aisle. They brush my elbow in passing, some turn to give me a smile. Is the almond blossom bitter? Is the grasshopper heavy to bear? Christ, make me happier, fitter to go to my own over there. Jerusalem the golden, what bliss beyond compare. My Lord, where I have offended, do thou forgive it me, that so, when all being ended, I hear thy last decree, I may go up to Jerusalem, out of Galilee."